Hello and welcome to Occupied Thoughts, a podcast brought to you by the Foundation for Middle East Peace. I'm Peter Beinart, non-resident fellow at FMEP. Today is May 3rd, 2024, and I'm delighted to be here with Professor Sahar Aziz. Sahar is Distinguished Professor of Law, Middle East Legal Studies Scholar, and Chancellor's Social Justice Scholar at Rutgers University Law School. Professor Aziz's scholarship examines the intersection of national security, race, religion, and civil rights, with a focus on the adverse impact of national security laws and policies on racial, religious, and ethnic minorities. She is the author of the book, The Racial Muslim, When Racism Quashes Religious Freedom, and founding director of the Center for Security, Race, and Rights. Sahar has won many awards, including being named a Soros Equality Fellow at the Open Society Foundation in 2021. I've been grateful to speak to Sahar in the past, but this conversation has become more urgent and pointed since the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Education and the Workforce launched an investigation into Rutgers University, an investigation that seems potentially aimed at curbing the work of the center. This is the same committee chaired by Representative Virginia Fox that has been holding these McCarthyist hearings with university presidents. Sahar, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you, Peter. It's a pleasure to be in conversation with you.
So tell me a little bit about when you learned that Rutgers might be under investigation and when these attacks on the center in particular began in this context.
Let me step back and just highlight a few key facts. The first is that the Center for Security, Race, and Rights at Rutgers Law School is the first and only academic civil rights center that focuses on Muslim, Arab, and South Asian communities. So its work is extremely important and necessary, and again, focuses primarily on this very diverse group of communities within the United States and what happens abroad as it affects them. And the only criticism that we have received and attacks that we have received by congressional leaders and elected officials has been when we invite Palestinian academics to present their work and their research. So we have over 90 lectures on our YouTube channel that we've been hosting over the past 5 years. But it is only when we host people like Rashid Khalidi, Columbia University historian, Lara Shiha, George Washington professor, university professor focused on psychoanalysis and social psychology, Professor Joseph Massad, Columbia University professor, and Noura Erekat, who is a professor at Rutgers. And every time we host one of these, we start to get attacked. But what's happened recently, the attacks have reached such a fever pitch and such a hysteria, largely because of the broader political context, obviously the war crimes by Hamas on October 7th, what I believe is the genocidal retaliatory response by Israel, and the college activism that we're seeing across the country. So the context has certainly made it where anyone's work related to Palestine, and especially in a way that centers Palestinians and their experiences and their perspectives, has been under the microscope. So in that backdrop, we started to get attacked first by the Senate Judiciary Committee in December, because a former board member, Adil Mangi, who is a nationally known litigator who has won remarkably complex litigation cases, both on a pro bono basis and also as part of his corporate law job, he was on our board of advisors. Adil Mangi is a Pakistani American who has no focus or expertise on the Middle East. He's done some pro bono work combating Islamophobia in the US. He gets nominated for the Third Circuit by Senator Cory Booker and Menendez and President Biden. He's the first Muslim to ever be nominated to the federal appellate court. Well, when he gets questioned by Ted Cruz, Tom Cotton, John Kennedy, all of whom are known for their very far right-wing politics, including support for the Muslim ban and other anti-Muslim policies of Donald Trump, the former president, instead of asking him about his qualifications, his experience, his education, they attack him on the account that he was a member of our board. And then they start accusing the Center for Security, Race, and Rights and me as being anti-Semitic, terrorism supporters, pro-Hamas. I could not have found anything more on point to support my own research that argues that Muslims have been racialized to their detriment, as I talk about in my book, The Racial Muslim, When Racism Quashes Religious Freedom. And if I was still writing it, this would have been a case study. And they just it just shows that if you are Muslim, you are subject to these stereotypes without question. And one of those stereotypes is that you hate Jews. That your religion teaches you to hate Jews, that your culture teaches you to hate Jews. And once people believe that, then anytime you're criticizing Israeli state practices and policies, suddenly you're anti-Semitic, right? Or if you're you're in a debate, a political debate with a colleague or with a neighbor or with a politician, and you're disagreeing with them on US foreign policy in Palestine, Israel, you're disagreeing with them on human rights issues related to Israel, suddenly you're accused of anti-Semitism. So that's effectively the kind of the backdrop. And so the House Committee, what I now call the House Un-American Activities Committee, because I don't think we can in good faith and with a straight face call it the House Committee on Education and the Workforce, but they have now built or grown off of, or I should say expanded, the Senate Judiciary Republican minorities attack. So they did not have, they don't have obviously majority status. And so when they were going after all these universities and they added Rutgers to their list for various reasons, but if you look at the letter that they sent to Rutgers, which is available online, the Center for Security, Race, and Rights takes up almost the whole page. And they're making accusations that we are supported by terrorists, funded by terrorists, we're a platform for terrorists, we're anti-American. I mean, it's just unbelievable the amount of vitriol and smearing and defamation that is in that official letter from the chair of a committee in the US Congress with absolutely no evidence, except what do they cite? Our lectures by university professors, our reports that are very well researched. And which professors do they take issue with? The Palestinian American ones. And I'll just note, as you and I both know, and for your audience, you were one of our esteemed guests, right? It was a pleasure to have you and Sarah Lee Whitson to come and talk about US foreign policy in Israel. Yet your name never came up, Peter, even though you do have critical perspectives on Israel. And that's just more evidence to me that this isn't about protecting the safety of Jews. This is about quashing and censoring any critique by Palestinians and then by Muslims, even if they're not Palestinian, who are experts who may actually have the credibility to engage in a more balanced and impartial debate.
So we're now clearly in the midst of a kind of an effort that's consuming a whole series of universities in which this committee is trying to get professors fired, students, you know, suspended and expelled. And if we go back to American history, again, the House Un-American Activities Committee, this may go on for a while. And I'm curious whether now that we've seen this being played out, we've seen a couple of versions of this committee's hearings with university presidents. What have you learned about the best way to respond and what people need to do to try, irrespective of their views, by the way, on Israel-Palestine, to protect academic freedom and free speech, which, by the way, was something that I thought before October 7th that I thought I used to hear a lot of conservatives say they really cared about.
Isn't it interesting and sometimes laughable the way in which people on the political right, and sometimes I will say even on the political left, will conveniently critique the other side of the
right.
political aisle for violating fundamental American values when it's to their interests. So I've learned quite a bit about the United States myself, although admittedly I was already a cynic. You know, when you spend 23 years of your professional life working on post 9/11 discrimination through the lens of national security law and civil rights law, it didn't take long for me to realize that America's ideals on paper do not apply in practice, especially to Muslims, Arabs, and South Asians, and those of us who have studied African-American history and the history of other minorities, including Jewish Americans, particularly in the first half of the 20th century. I mean, we all know that rights on paper don't always translate rights into practice. But I did admittedly still hold the somewhat idealistic view that the university was still sacred ground. That yes, in the political sphere and in the public square and when dealing with the citizens or the public, that there was a lot of double standards. But I had expected that academics and university administrators and professors were more sophisticated in appreciating that you must stick to your principles rather than act so unabashedly in your self-interest, whether it's economically or professionally or ideologically. So I have learned, I think a lot of us have learned, that we are certainly in a kind of crisis moment for academic freedom in higher education. And what we need to do, and I'm very grateful to over 520 law professors who signed a letter issued to the committee that effectively stood by my academic freedom rights, the center's academic freedom rights, and all of our academic freedom rights, but also just noted that this isn't about whether you agree with a professor's analysis or whether you agree with a particular academic center's approach to a topic. It's the right to be able to do that without retaliation, without being punished and smeared and losing your job and having your reputation tarnished or being accused of all kinds of, you know, awful names. Because that doesn't, I mean, yes, we're used to that in the political sphere, but I can say for myself, I'm intentionally an academic. I'm not interested in being a politician, right? So I think the best way to respond is to stick to our principles. And it's a test for all of us. I mean, I've thought a lot about what if this had happened to a colleague that was on the political right, who, for example, may have very strong views that support Israel in ways that I find either incorrect analytically or even offensive because of the consequence that it's had on Palestinians in Gaza, right? Let's not forget, we're talking about 44,000 people that have been killed in the last 7 months, 34,000 confirmed, 10,000 missing under the rubble, which there's no way that they're still alive, right? Given the time, plus you've got another 80,000 that have been injured. Many of them have been severely injured with amputations. And then you have 2.4 million that have been systematically starved. So these are high stakes. But if I had a colleague, whether at my university or another, who took a position that was analytically contrary to mine, I would never want their center to be closed. I would never want them to be punished. I would certainly want to compete with them in the marketplace of ideas, and I would certainly want to debate them, and I would debate them without engaging in ad hominem attacks, which has been something that I've been subjected to quite a bit. And I have to say that as a critical race theorist and as an intersectionality theorist, you know, I've done research on intersectionality, I have just been really disappointed with many white male law professors and white male so-called, you know, intellectual elites who have just, the way they disagreed with me and other women of color has been through ad hominem attacks that are just unabashed. That it's something you're just not used to seeing in the academy, or used to seeing it more again in front of a House Un-American Activities Committee. So we're all being tested. And I think that the young people in college and universities are watching us, and they're realizing that maybe our generation failed, right? Maybe what's happening with these universities is not the universities they want. It's too corporate, it's too restrictive, and that these administrators have become more interested in their own careers and in their own large paychecks, as opposed to actually creating an environment where students are forced to have to think about things very critically, even if it means they're going to be a little uncomfortable, even if it means they might be offended, not because they're personally attacked, because that's not acceptable. That is not, no one can learn when they're constantly being individually targeted or harassed. But you've got to be able to learn by having exposure to different ideas.
Right. I want to try to cast this question in the way that I think some of those folks on the right might cast it, because this is one of the things I've heard them say, where they say, you know, the left is now, progressives are now, you know, championing free speech. But over the past few years, They have not been advocates of free speech when it comes to conservatives on campus. And there has been a climate where things, conservative opinions get called racist or homophobic or sexist. And then basically people lose their jobs or speeches or people disinvited from speeches or protests are disrupted. And so, so we don't think you're in good faith now, that not speaking you, but progressives more generally, when you express your anger about intrusions of free speech, we're basically just doing to you what you did to us. So I'm curious, do you think there's any validity to that? How would you respond?
I think it's a fair critique as long as one appreciates that the left or those that are left of center is a spectrum and they don't all agree in how to respond to disagreement. It's just like the right is a spectrum. We are right now getting overexposed to those on the farther right because of the legacy of Donald Trump and the way he's moved the Republican Party and kind of conservative politics so far to the right. But I don't believe that all Republicans or all those who identify as conservative or right of center necessarily agree with all of his policies or his basis policies. So I do think that, yes, on the left, and I was certainly one of those people who disagreed with the so-called cancel culture. And I used to advise my students when they would get really upset that somebody was invited that they thought had beliefs that were in fact Islamophobic, that they could prove for, or that were in fact anti-Black, or that were in fact sexist. And I would tell them, as somebody who has studied and written and researched on authoritarianism, you know, of all places in the Middle East, I have a deep appreciation for once you set a certain rule, it can be used against you. So be careful when you think that a rule is good or you support it because it is being applied to someone you believe is an opponent, politically or ideologically. But always ask yourself, what if they had power? And then that same rule is applied. Is that the type of society you want to live in? I can tell you, as somebody who is committed to the rule of law, democracy, equality, I did not believe in cancel culture. Now, there are two caveats. So the first thing that I would advise students is I would say, you don't have to show up. You can boycott it. You can have a protest outside as long as it doesn't disrupt it. You can have an alternative event at the same time to make it where there's very few people that actually show up to that event, which limits the impact of that speaker. You can go to the university and ask for fair resources to be distributed so that you could bring another speaker or have another event that effectively challenges the same ideas or analysis that is brought by this particular speaker or event. In other words, compete. Compete with the ideas. Now, that only works, and this is where things get really complicated, especially if you are a minority, you know, whether you're a racial minority, sexual orientation minority, gender minority, pick your minority or a relatively less powerful group, is that the marketplace of ideas, one big flaw in the concept is it assumes equal access to the marketplace of ideas. We know that's not true in mainstream media. We know that's not true in any elected office. When you see the disproportionate representation of whites, of white males, right? Of people of a certain age, for example, or people of a certain immigrant or non-immigrant status, et cetera. So that's one of the challenges I think that universities have to address, and they can, is to make sure that those students who have less power as a result usually of their numbers, or perhaps as the group's wealth as represented in society, that they do have equal access and that there is that kind of sensitivity to it. The other caveat is, I do believe there is such thing as low value speech. Now, if you have a marketplace of ideas that's perfect, and I know I'm sounding very capitalistic because American law is based in capitalism, then the theory is the quote unquote high value ideals will race to the top, right, so the top and the low value ideas will fall to the bottom. But we're seeing that with social media, that's not happening, right? So I think that the key issue here is if universities and faculty need to be responsible in bringing people that actually add value in students' analytical skills and understanding. That doesn't mean they have to agree with them, but it's similar to citations in an article. You can't just write opinion. You can't just be a pundit. What's your source? What's your research? What's your methodology? And that, I think, is about quality and quality control. And that is the difference between maybe a public protest in a public park and an academic event or a conference or some kind of panel discussion or keynote speech at a university. And that does, and I do think that that is an important distinction because universities have a very specific mission that should be ideologically neutral, but pedagogically sound and academically sound.
I wanted to ask about the legal basis on which the Congress may try to make claims, to use claims of anti-Semitism in order to shut down free speech. You're a legal scholar, I'm not, but what are the ways in which, is it Title VI or Title IX could be used or would need to be changed in basically be able to say, well, this person is saying Israel doesn't have a right to exist, and therefore that's an attack on Jews, and therefore that's discrimination and should be punished.
Yeah. This is again, legally, it's a very interesting situation or analysis that brings, it clashes two legal interests and legal rights, which is a common thing that happens when, you know, engaging legal analysis. But on the one hand, you have First Amendment, free speech, free expression. And on the other hand, you have essentially anti-discrimination statutes, which in theory or in principle kind of arise out of equal protection principles in the 14th Amendment. But these are statutes that we're talking about. And Title VI is from the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which of course was opposed by all conservatives until the present day there still. And now you have a lot of political conservatives who are, you know, ironically using Title VI for their own political purposes. And Title VI effectively states that any entity, private or public, that receives federal funding cannot discriminate in its provision of services based on three factors, three categories: race, color, or national origin. Now, this is when you get into the question of, well, are Jews a race, a color, or a national origin? And in fact, that was exactly the same question I had when I started writing the book, The Racial Muslim, is I was trying to understand how do you use a Title VI to stop the NYPD and other police departments from engaging in racial profiling in surveillance and in national security law enforcement. And if you are a Muslim, that technically doesn't count. If you're Palestinian, it does. If you're Egyptian, right? If you're Arab. Now, in 2019, Trump issued an executive order that stated very clearly that Jews are covered by Title VI. And that executive order was not reversed or rescinded by Biden. And therefore, at least based on that executive order, which hasn't been challenged, you know, in court, Jews, for practical purposes, are being treated as a protected class under Title VI. And then going from there, those who are pro-Israeli are arguing that the various protests are effectively forms of discrimination against Jewish students, and therefore universities have a legal obligation under Title VI to stop these protests and to stop the sit-ins and the teach-ins. And if they don't, then they will lose their Title VI funding, which is a significant amount of funds. And private universities, as well as public universities, receive Title VI funds. So then the question is, what is it that's allegedly anti-Semitic? Well, many of us have heard in the news saying the phrase "from the river to the sea," saying from the phrase "from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," saying the phrase "free Palestine," intifada, or global intifada, right? Now, if you want to then we're into a factual analysis, a factual dispute. What do those terms mean? And as we know, there is a huge dispute. If we go back 50 years, there's probably not as much of a dispute as to at least what "from the river to the sea" means. Because at that point in time, this was when it was a minority view that, at least on the Palestinian perspective, that Israel was a legitimate nation state. But we're now in 2024, and the real debate is more about two-state solution or one state solution that is not an ethno-nationalist or ethno-religious state, and whatever you want to call that state, Palestine, Israel, Israel, Palestine, or some hybrid, and however you want to structure that state, whether it's like the United States or France, or whether it's like Lebanon, where it has, you know, it's sectarian by design and has some form of autonomy. And that's many of the, you know, these are the topics that you've enlightened us a lot about from your analysis. But that's really what those two things mean by the vast majority of these students. So to say that this is a call for genocide is just, that's bad faith. And no one has actually taken the time that is alleging that these are calls for genocide to interview the students, to do surveys, to actually ask all these students that are out there protesting, what do you mean by that? What is your objective? And when news reporters do ask them, they say, we want to stop the violence in Gaza. We want a ceasefire. We want the hostages to be returned as part of a ceasefire. We want to stop the military occupation. We want to stop the settlements and the home demolitions of Palestinians, and so on and so forth. So they want more peace, less war, but in a way that treats Palestinians as humans, right? Not as merely occupied subjects or victims of ethnic cleansing, and again, what I believe are at least genocidal practices. But as you may know, and as many in your audience may know, there is a definitional debate. So the International Holocaust Remembrance Association is IHRA.
Alliance.
Is claiming, well, the person who actually was part of defining it, I believe his name is Ken Stern, has stated that it is not actually correct what the advocates of IHRA are stating, which is that one of the examples of anti-Semitism is alleging that Israel is a racist state and that Israel is engaging, or criticizing the state of Israel in a way that is very targeted to treating it exceptionally. Of course, they don't have a problem if you treat it exceptionally in terms of exempting it from human rights laws. You just can't, you can't criticize it. But I think that there's two other definitions. One is the Nexus document. One is the Jerusalem Declaration. Based on my readings, I think the Jerusalem Declaration is the better of the three insofar as distinguishing and separating the state of Israel as a nation state, which, by the way, has the strongest military in the region, perhaps, in, you know, arguably vis-a-vis Iran, may have equally strong or equally at that same level, has nuclear weapons, and is not in any way a vulnerable state militarily, especially as compared to its neighbors. Yes, population-wise, it's much smaller, but as far as its military is concerned, it's quite powerful and very well-funded with our $4 billion per year of our taxpayer dollars, and we just approved another, our Congress approved just another $14 billion a year, right? So separating the criticism of that state and its violations of international law from the religion of Judaism, right? And the people who follow that religion nationwide, which I believe now has reached, what, 12 million? Is that correct, Peter?
I don't know the exact number, but it sounds plausible, yeah.
Yeah, and because I always use the example, can you imagine how our First Amendment rights would be implicated if the same level of aggression and vitriol and coercion and bad faith legislation was occurring vis-a-vis anyone who criticized Iran. And we had some definition of Islamophobia that included criticism of Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Afghanistan. Why? Because those were self-declared, well, theocracy. Saudi Arabia is a monarchy, but it claims to be, you know, based, it is the home of Sunni Islam. Iran is the home of Shia Islam. And the Taliban now, who have taken control of Afghanistan, claim to be, you know, they want a religious state. It's an outrageous proposition. And so I actually think that they do want Israel to be treated exceptionally, but in ways that allow it to violate international law with no or little accountability. And I just want to state, and I have a pretty strong record showing this because of my research, I don't think that that means you don't criticize Arab states for their human rights violations.
Right.
And many of us do. And one of the main reasons why we should be very interested in how Israel behaves vis-a-vis human rights and Jordan and Egypt and Afghanistan, and I would say Iraq, is because they receive a lot of our money. So anywhere we're sending our money, our taxpayer money, we absolutely should be paying attention to what they're doing with that money, especially when it's military aid.
One last question. You mentioned earlier that the students' dissatisfaction with universities. I'm wondering, what are the different ways in you think that this moment may change universities and what may come out of them? Since it seems to me that they're being tested. Many of them are not doing very well. I think there seems to me there are real questions about if universities were to take the principled stance that I think you and I would like them to do, what would that actually mean in terms of the resources available to them, given the consequences it could have for their relationship with the federal government, their relationship with donors? So I'm just curious if you have thoughts about what are the potential directions that universities may go in response to this kind of McCarthyist moment.
Well, there's a structural crisis and there's a leadership crisis. And even if you fix the leadership crisis, that just will mitigate the problem, but it could just rise up again. So the leadership problem is kind of what it says, is you have people in leadership positions in administrative offices across the country at universities who have clearly lost sight of their job description. Because they seem to think their job description is to only serve the donors and elected officials and their own pockets, right? Their paychecks, their large paychecks. And they seem to have forgotten that their objective is to serve all the students working together in shared governance with the faculty. And this is why they get accused of kind of this corporate CEO model where it's much more directive rather than collaborative. And that is a culture crisis. And what makes it, you know, even more, I think, tragic is many of these presidents themselves were faculty. And the fact that they could so easily just dismiss and disregard the values that we all share as faculty who value academic freedom, because we know without it, we couldn't do our work with high quality. We'd be too afraid. We'd be thinking of what's the political consequence of my findings rather than truth-seeking. Let me try, based on methodological tests or processes within my discipline, to try to seek out the truth, right? Whatever that may be. So but there are presidents, like the one at Columbia, who's not an academic. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of faculty don't want non-academics to be presidents of universities, because they are not acculturated to this unique environment that is intended to allow people to think freely, independently. And when they're critiqued on their methodology, right? They're critiqued on whether or not the input is accurate and the process is accurate, right? It's more about process. It's not about whether I agree with your conclusion or not. It's more about how did you get to that conclusion? And that's all fair game. The structural problem, which I fear is going to be very difficult to solve, and I think the students have woken up to it, and I hope the faculty across the country who weren't as sensitive to it have become more sensitive to it, which is that universities have an economic model that almost guarantees they will be these businesses that seek to please the consumer or the political, and the consumers may be the donors, right? The people who pay them, not the students, but the donors or the government, in ways that we're seeing exactly what's happening at Columbia, at Harvard. Now, one caveat is students are realizing the power of their collective action, because together they actually can make quite a big influence. Alone, they can't, right? So for example, just like faculty can strike or staff can strike and just shut down the university, what if students were to somehow decide that they were going to all disenroll for a semester? That would bankrupt a lot of universities, because the donor money matters, but it's really the revenue, that the primary source of revenue is tuition, which is why tuition has gone up so much, because state government and federal government has defunded, especially public universities, such that in the 1970s, I believe the average percentage of a public university's budget that came from the state was about 70%. Now it's 20 to 25%. So the universities, public universities, are relying on tuition and donations and grants. And so all that is to say that we can't just approach this simply from a free speech issue or a Palestine-Israel issue. We do have a crisis in higher education. And all I would say to those who are skeptical or who don't think the crisis is that serious or that there is a crisis is I would tell you to go study how universities function or dysfunction in authoritarian states, or how they function and dysfunction when they are serving private sector needs or political ideological objectives, as opposed to truth seeking and having, these pedagogy and methodologically sound processes and disciplines. And you will see very quickly that the quality goes down. And ultimately, you know where their students usually come? They come to us here in the US. That's why they want to come here and faculty want to come here. So even if you are a capitalist and you want to think in that term, the way that the higher education model is historically structured in America does produce higher quality over the long run, even if it's not popular, what is said by professors or
Yeah,
written by professors.
that's a very, very important, that's a very important point. That part of what's at stake here, among many other things in this moment, is the question of the reputation of American universities as among the best in the world. Sahar, thank you so much for joining me today. And thank you to our listeners for tuning into this episode of Occupied Thoughts. Please make sure to check out the FMAP website, fmap.org, for resources related to this podcast and lots of other rich content related to Palestine and Israel. And please make sure you're subscribed to this podcast to stay up to date. You can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Spotify, and you can watch video versions of our podcast, including this one, on YouTube. And with that, I'm Peter Beinart, signing off until the next episode of FMAP's Occupied Thoughts.